me that you went home and swiped a ball that was signed by Babe Ruth, and you brought it out here and actually played with it, and actually played with it? Yeah.
Are you one of those people that has to know how much the Babe Ruth ball is actually worth?
I was going to bring it back, but it was signed by Babe Ruth. Yeah, you keep telling me that. Who is she?
We'll keep it right here, because today is your lucky day.
The Sultan of Flight. King of Crash. The Colossus of Cloud. The Colossus of Cloud.
It's time for Sports Collecting with Tom Morgan, sponsored by ERC Delivery and Huggins and Scott Auctions.
The Great Bambino!
Good morning, I'm Tom Morgan with Vince Clementi of ERC Delivery, Bill Huggins of Huggins and Scott Auctions, our producer Eric Ostrowski, and we have a guest with us, a celebrity guest with us this week, John Drummond, longtime Channel 2 Chicago newsman. And John Drummond has to have gone to more sporting events than anybody in the history of sports, judging by, John, that box full of ticket stubs you stopped by T-Crown with the other day. You've been to quite a few sporting events in your life.
Yes, we have. There's no denying that. We did actually work as in the sports field also at different stations, including Channel 2, but I've kept a lot of that stuff, being like a rat pack of materials, and I did. Some of those were in the press box, and some of those were legitimate, just regular ducats for various games, ranging from boxing matches to football games, golf events, you name it.
Yeah, any big events that really stand out that you went to through your history?
Well, I think I was a boxing fan at the time, watching the tickets for the Don Kakel Rocky Marciano fight. I saw that fight out in the Kezar Stadium in San Francisco back in 1955.
Wow.
Of course, Marciano was unbeaten, retired unbeaten, and boxing was big also in that day. Bear that in mind. I remember I got tickets for the Bear Giant game in 63, which the Bears won 14-10 on a very cold day in Wrigley Field, things of that nature.
The championship game you went to?
Yeah, the 60. That was before the Super Bowl.
Wow, yeah.
The equivalent of a Super Bowl, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
And a number of golf events, including the U.S. Open, several of those, one in San Francisco and several at Medina that were here, and the PGA championships, things of that nature.
Now, was Marciano as impressive in person as it looked like on film of him, like as far as it seemed like he's one of the best punchers in history?
Yeah, he would take a lot of punishment. He'd wear you down, and that was his main strength. And of course, also he's fighting a lot of the guys who were a little over the hill when he fought him, like Joe Walcott and Ezra Charles. But he was a great champion. There's no question about it. He just was in tremendous condition. Would wear you down, hit hard. Oh, he would wear you down. For example, when he's fighting Roland Lestarza in 1953 at in New York City. He just kept hammering Lestarza's arms and shoulders so bad he couldn't raise his fists anymore, and so he KO'd Lestarza, I think, around the 10th round.
Wow.
So Marciano was quite a guy. I interviewed him also, by the way, one-on-one one time. He's an interesting guy, to put it mildly. And, of course, a tragedy, died as a young man in a plane crash.
Yeah.
And 1969, right in Newton, Iowa, when he was flying out to a fair in Des Moines. He didn't have to go up. He went in a private plane. They told him the weather was bad, but he disregarded that, felt he was invincible, I guess, and then died in that crash.
You also interviewed Willie Gallimore, the old Bears running back, who also, he died in a car crash.
Yeah, funny, ironically, the 1964 season, Gallimore was had an offense at DeKalb. I recall going over there. I worked at Channel 13 in Rockford at the time. And we interviewed Gallimore at that time on camera just before the training camp began. And then Gallimore went over to the training camp. The Bears trained then at Rensselaer, Indiana.
Yeah.
In Lake Forest, of course. And a fellow by the name of John Farrington, who was an end with him. I remember he always had a toothpick in his mouth when he played. But anyway,
really?
They went out, they were in an accident. I can't recall right now who was driving, but they both killed shortly after camp began, right after camp. So that was one of the last interviews. Tragic story. Gallimore's an exciting ball player.
Yeah.
I recall in that 63 title game, I don't think they put him in the game because he was prone to fumble.
Oh.
And it was cold weather, and they just couldn't risk it, even though he was a very flashy runner, a precursor to Gale Sayers. I mean, he was a very dangerous, exciting player to watch.
There's that famous picture from that 63 Bears title game where Y.A. Tittle's kneeling down with blood pouring down his head.
Well, the Bears knocked Tittle out of the game, and that basically was it. And without Tittle, they had another guy with it. Griffin, whoever their quarterback was, nowhere near as strong as Tittle was, and the result was that the Bears managed to win it 14-10, although thankfully they were outplayed. It was a great defensive struggle.
Yeah, and at Wrigley Field, a lot of people don't
realize
that. That's
right, people. It's not at Soldier Field. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah. Now, Bill Huggins is, any type of value to Marciano boxing ticket stubs and the Bears championship game from 63? Those
well,
types
I had
of
the
tickets?
I had the Conkell thing. I've seen it misplaced. I'll have to take a good look.
Oh, you got to find that one. Go
yeah, that's
get...
a good one. Well, that was one of the famous fights. Of course, we had great bouts here in Chicago that I didn't have tickets of. You know, the Marciano, the Graziano fights. Marciano fought in Chicago. KO's Walcott here. People forget about that.
Yeah.
So they had a local, it was a local angle on that, but I got to see if I can find that someday.
Bill Huggins, any value to the I would think Marciano ticket stubs would be good.
Oh, and John, I'm sure that a lot of these things I heard you mention earlier are press credentials or press passes and stuff like that, which are a whole different collectible in their own right. We've sold quite a number of former writers, former columnists, former, you know, broadcasters' press credentials, and those are way harder to get than a ticket to the game because there's only a few of them, maybe 50 or 100, I don't know, depending on the event, whereas the regular tickets to the game, there were thousands, tens of thousands.
Well, I know one thing I have on some of the stubs that you don't see anymore. So Northwestern games in the press box, because I work in some of those games, it's printed on those tickets are... Women and children not admitted.
Yeah.
I'm serious. This is
really?
Like 1957, as recent as that. That women and 58, women and children not permitted. It says right on your press pass.
Wow.
In the press box.
Isn't that something?
By the way, if I may, might make an anecdote little on that Marciano fight, if I can go a second. Of course, that fight, why it was in Frisco, right in New York, I don't know. And they only had about 18,000 at Kezar Stadium. I was in the service at that time. We had crappy tickets. I remember that much. And everybody was in the boondocks, myself included. We all rushed to the better seats before the fight started. And I remember I was sitting behind Johnny Weissmuller and his wife, and they were furious that they paid big dough. I snuck in before. I remember that.
Really? Yeah. Right behind Tarzan?
Tarzan himself. And the woman, I assume, was his wife. Yeah, he was very unhappy about it. That's Law of the Jungle, I can tell him.
Actually,
so that would have been a good autograph, but I guess if he was that mad that you were sitting there,
I don't think that was a good idea. Yeah. Don't forget, I thought about that, but I didn't think it was a good idea to try to say that.
By the way, Tarzan, since I'm here, do you mind if you sign in this for me?
Yeah, he'd like that.
Well, the number here is 312-332-3776. Just like a normal program, you can call in with a question about the value of your collectibles. You can also tweet a picture of an item. T Crown Tom is my Twitter ID. We have another good prize this week. Last week's winner picked up their prize. Well, they didn't pick them up. They contacted Vince at ERC Delivery, and ERC delivered. That was a nice prize package. But the prize this week is a 2016 Panini Contenders Draft Picks football box. The draft starts a week from Thursday, so this has 5 autographs in this box of guys who are projected to be draft picks in the 2016 draft.
I was kind of tempted to open it last night. It was sitting on my shelf, and I know it's part of this week's prize, but it's just sitting right there. You know?
That's why I thought, okay, we'll put that little sticker on there that says, Vince Radio Show. Radio Show prize. Yeah. But the number's 312-332-3776. You have a question about the value of an item, you get in the drawing. Or if you have a question for John Drummond, our guest today, longtime Channel 2 Chicago newsman. John, did you have anybody that you worked with over the years that was especially impressive as a news person?
Oh, yes, we had several. I think certainly at Channel 2 we had a lot of people that went on to the network, like Bob Faw and others, and certainly Bill Curtis, a hard worker, and Walter Jacobson, who was an inside man pretty much with his perspective, that is, his commentaries at night, were very strong. At one time, Channel 2 in the late 60s and early 70s period, I take it back, late 70s, early 80s, was so dominant there was no station in the country that could match it. It was the pride and joy of CBS.
Yeah.
And part of that was, number one, we moved the newsroom to the, I mean, we moved the newscast from the studio into the newsroom with the teletypes going clang, bang, bang. It was a great gimmick, and that caught on. They molded together Walter Jacobson and Curtis as the anchor team, which had the great chemistry. And last but not least, we're the first one to have the minicam. And so that, in other words, be able to go out and get live shots all the time. And that was a great gimmick for a good time. And that caught people on. Once they started watching, they stayed with us. And that was, those factors combined together made Channel 2's news operation very, very successful. Dominated this market.
Yeah, the ratings at that time, weren't they pretty much you guys number one for most of
that
time?
Yeah, they were number one for some time. And I'll tell you one thing people forget, that at that time, a Of course, there was no internet. There was no cable. And they're very, even the U stations did do an awful lot. So the people in this market and other markets would watch that 10 o'clock news religiously. Our people
yeah.
today, of course, you don't have the number of people watching the show that you did then.
No internet, no cable. I remember when my kids were young, they were like, did they have cars when you were young?
It's yeah,
like,
don't,
yeah, they had cars.
When I started, there was no TV, so I came back away. So
right.
I'd say that one.
I was telling Vince, I think at T-Crown this week that, you know, the first time I ever went to a baseball game, it was Wrigley Field, and we had a black and white TV, so I never saw Wrigley Field in color, and I was probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, and when you're walking up and going to the park, and it was a cool day, a sunny day, and they open up these big doors, and we walk in there, and the breeze comes down, and all the color, I was like, oh my God, it, you know, I was like, this is like heaven, this is unbelievable. Yeah, they didn't have remotes then either, my kids couldn't believe that.
It was as if you were like reliving the emotion of seeing those doors open, that was amazing.
Yeah, oh, it was incredible.
My daughter asked me, how did you guys live without cell phones?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Cell phones, remote controls. That's you right. had to get up and change the channel.
God forbid.
Yeah,
right. That's right. There was no remotes in those days. That's right. Exactly right.
Right. There'd be 50 million people watching the Beverly Hillbillies, too, because there were only three channels or four channels. Caribou Jeff is on the line. What do you have there, Caribou Jeff?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hi.
Good. I have a 1985 82nd Western Open Golf Championship cardboard poster. It's actually signed by the winner, Scott Verplec, which was amateur, and the runner-up.
Oh, who was the runner-up?
Jim Thorpe.
Jim Thorpe. Huh. Too bad it wasn't...
Not the Jim Thorpe, by the way, that the Olympic star went on to the champion tour. And by the way, what made that, as this gentleman pointed out, Verplec was an amateur, and that made that so unique. I think he's about the only amateur to win the Western Open, at least in modern times.
What? So
he was the first amateur to actually win the tour since Doug Sanders in 1956 in the Canada Open. So like 29 years ago, guys.
So were you covering that, John?
No, I went out. Didn't cover it, but I as a witness, I saw Verplank play. I went out that it was out at it was Oak Brook at that time. They played the Western Open there.
Yeah.
And that's where it was. I remember that thing. My God, that was a big story at the time because Verplank was an unknown and an amateur taking on all those guys, and he won the thing. But he didn't win any money out of it. The second place guy, at the point, I got first place money.
Oh, think about that. That doesn't seem fair. I don't know. But
no.
Bill Huggins now, because that was an amateur who won that, what do you think? Does that help value because it's unusual, or he's never turned out to be a huge name, so it's not as good? Or what do you think of something like that?
Oh, probably a little of both. I mean, it's still a unique, the fact that an amateur won, like John was saying, that's very rare. I think Mickelson won as an amateur one time, but it would have to be a unique type situation as far as what that would sell for. Is it signed by just the winner in second place or even more guys?
It's actually signed by the winner, the runner-up, and actually the artist, Walt Pitzmiller.
Huh.
Oh, okay.
So
how big is it?
The size is about 31 by 17 and 17.5 maybe.
Okay.
Is it original artwork or is it a print?
This one is actually a print, but like I said, it is signed by the artist pen, and then it's actually signed by the two golfers in pencil.
What do you think, Bill? Would that be worth a shot in a Huggins and Scott auction, or what do you think?
I would definitely want to give it a try. I mean, we've got a lot of golf fans out there, and I mean, this is there can't be too many of these out there.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything, guys.
That's pretty neat. So if you want to contact Bill Huggins about getting into the August auction with that, the number is 301-608-0355, and call him during the week. That'd be interesting. So anything unusual like that, I mean, you just never know what it's going to happen in an auction with items like that. Here's some things. This was kind of neat. In the upcoming May auction, I just noticed this the other day, Bill, you have a 3,000 hit club collage with 24 signatures, including Clemente, Ty Cobb, Honus Wagner. Now, here's a debate we had at T-Crown the other day with Brett, who we question his pronunciation sometimes. How do you pronounce it? I pronounce it Lajoie. How do you pronounce him, Bill? Is there, like, one way that most of the vintage guys pronounce his name, his last name?
The way you just said it, Lajoie. Other people call it LaJoy or
yeah.
LaJoie.
I thought it was LaJoie. I've heard it as just plain that, LaJoie. I don't know if that's true or not. That's how some
yeah, see, a lot. There's a lot of different ways, but Lajoie is the way I've always thought it was
how
supposed
is Brett
to be
pronouncing it? What does he think?
Well, Brett says Bauman rather than Bowman, so I'm going to ignore what Brett has to say. Brett, sorry about that out there, but well, let's see. Before our break here, we've got Wayne on the line. One quick call here before the break. So what's up, Wayne? What do you have? Thanks for calling. Hey, Wayne. Are you with us? Oh, Rich. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, hello. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi. What's up?
I have a question for John Drummond. Did Marciano fight Joe Louis when Joe yes. Louis was on his yes. way down? I know he beat him up badly.
Yes, he did. They fought in October '51 at the Garden, and Marciano scored a K over Louis, and that was Louis's last fight.
Yeah. And I have two Long Ranger comic books from 1955. Beautiful artwork on the covers for 10 cents. You know, they're frameable and they're autographed by Jay Silverheels and Clayton Moore. What's the value on that, please?
Wow, that's pretty cool, Bill. I've never seen one of those. Have you had run something like that before?
Gosh, I know we've sold Clayton Moore autographs, and I don't know about on a comic book. I'd have to do some research on that, Rich, but those could be great items for our auction. If you want to get back with me one day, I'd be happy to revisit that with you.
Did Silver the Horse sign it also?
Got the hoof there.
No, he couldn't.
All right, well, that would definitely be a Huggins and Scott auction item, and it's 301-608-0355. Well, it's time for a short break now. The number's 312-332-3776. We're on till 9. You can give us a call with a question about the value of your collectibles, or we have John Bulldog Drummond as a guest with us today. So if you have a question for him, give us a call. And we're giving away a real good prize, a 2016 Panini Contenders football box. Why can't I say that?
Sure.
It's a tongue twister. So hang in there. We'll be right back.
Now back to Sports Collecting with Tom Morgan. Sponsored by ERCDelivery.com and Huggins and Scott Auctions on ESPN 1000 and ESPNChicago.com.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Morgan from Triple Crown in Naperville with Vince Clemente of ERC Delivery and Bill Huggins of Huggins and Scott Auctions. We're on every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Central Time taking your questions about the value of your collectibles. The number here is 312-332-3776. You can give us a call with a question and you get in a drawing. Each week we give away a prize. This week it's a 2016 Panini Contenders Draft Picks football box with 5 autographs per box. It's like a $125 box, a good prize again
nice.
This week. And it's all guys that are projected to be in the draft this year. And you'll Goff and Carson Wentz, those guys signed in there, and they go for good money on eBay. So give us a call. You can also tweet a question at TCrownTom is my Twitter ID. And if you have a picture of an item that we use on the show, you'll get in the drawing. For instance, Pete here from Twitter tweeted a picture. He's got a Cal Ripken Jr. signed Topps rookie card. This is the rookie card, Bill, that has 3 players on it. So that would have been not the Topps traded, I guess. I think you've run those before, haven't you? A Ripken signed rookie card?
Yes, I believe we have. I want to say one of the guys on there, Bonner or something.
Yeah, Bob Bonner.
He died, I think, kind of early. So to get that card signed by all 3 of them is really tough.
Really?
Not because of Ripken, but because of one of the other 2 guys.
So then it really boils down to if it's really great condition, you might have some good value in it. But it looks like the one that Pete has is good. I would think that's got to be at least a couple hundred dollars with Ripken signing it and in nice shape. And then if you ever bring an item in to Triple Crown in Naperville, during the week, if I tweet a picture of it and then mention it on the show, then you also get in the drawing. For instance, Joe from Schaumburg stopped by this week. He had a 1966 Chicago Bears media guide signed by many of the Bears inside, including Mike Ditka, but the big one on there actually is Brian Piccolo, who died at such a young age. John Drummond, did you ever interview Brian Piccolo or cover the whole thing with him at all?
No, I didn't. By the way, his wife later worked at Channel 2 for a while. Joy was her name, and worked for a while, and she then left there, and she became a nurse, if I recall.
Hmm.
So I never interviewed Piccolo itself. But by the way, the gentleman calls in, I think I have a 66 Bears media guide, but unlike him, I don't have them autographed, so that may not be
valuable. Yeah. Yeah, well,
just one thing, if I can just interject.
Sure.
I did want to ask you, Tom, the other day, I didn't bring it up, and Bill is on here. This has not been the case, but in the 30s, 40s, and up to the 50s, when you go to the college football game, they would have little badges they would put out with the color of the team, say Michigan, with the colors Michigan on it, and hanging down be a miniature football hanging down on it. All of the schools did that, Minnesota, Notre Dame, all of them. They don't do that anymore. I wonder if they would be any value by that. Bill, of course, would know that. Maybe that he'd seen that. You ever seen those, what I call badges? They're like buttons.
Hmm.
Says, oh, Minnesota, yeah, 100%. And you're right, John. Those do have quite a bit of value. And like you said, they don't do that anymore, those ornate-type pins and stuff like that.
Yeah, pins, you can call them pins, badges. And they all had a football dangling down with the stripes of the color of the ribbon with the school colors on them. It was a good gimmick, it was. People wore them all the time when they went to the games, usually, to show their support. And nowadays, everybody
wears
jackets.
You still have a bunch of those left?
Pardon?
You still have a bunch of those left?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay, great.
Bill, he's putting together quite the package here for a Huggins and Scott auction, I think.
Those would be nice, but yeah. I don't have that much compared to what you guys do. But a lot of things. May I interject one other story, and then I'll keep my mouth yap shut on.
No, wait, we enjoy your stories,
yes, we
John.
Do.
We're on until 9. You can tell as many stories as you want.
Well, listen, I mentioned this to you, Tom, before, and you seem to say that prick a little interest, although there's not autographs on it. In 1962, we're going back to boxing again. I'm sorry, but at one time that was pretty big. Floyd Patterson fought Sonny Liston at Comiskey Park.
Oh, yeah.
In 1962, and KO'd him in one round. And I still was working in Rockford at that time. We went over, the manager sent us over to both camps to cover the thing. And he wanted to have one of his better sponsors, a guy named Swede Clark, who was an automobile dealer in Rockford, have his picture taken with Patterson. Well, that's not very easy to get that. It was the last day he was really working out. I mean, some guy from a small town getting in there is not going to work. But he figured that would be all right. And by the way, Swede Clark was a disciple of a guy named Jim Moran, who a lot of your older listeners today may remember was quite a hustler on TV, the first guy to do it in cars in Chicago.
Oh, huh.
But anyway, to make a long story short, I do have the still guy who took a lot of still pictures of both Liston and Patterson, Liston at camp and Patterson at camp, whether they'd be worth anything or not. But if I may just interject one thing, how we were able to get that interview with Patterson. You can imagine the media descended on the camp, which was near Elgin. It was the last chance for the media to talk to these people. And I got there figuring I didn't have a chance to probably get a one-on-one. They wanted a one-on-one on Patterson, and that was very unlikely. But I did. When I arrived on the scene, a guy named Sam Taub was the publicity man for the camp. Now, Sam Taub used to do the fights on radio for Adam's Hats. So when I got there, I talked to Mr. Taub and interviewed him. It was not a phony interview. I really was impressed by him, and we did use it. And while we were there, a couple of the sparring partners came by, and one of them was young Jack Johnson, I remember. We interviewed him, and we, of course, then made the pitch to get Patterson, and Taub said, well, I know he's working off a hate right now, taking a walk. I don't think it's going to be possible. But what happened was, because we did Taub and we did Johnson, one of their sparring partners, the word got back to Patterson. This is a different type deal, and we got an exclusive interview with Floyd Patterson and got the picture with Swede Clark and him shaking hands.
Wow.
Which was rather cool. In fact, Tom Bolin, one of the promoters, came by. He says, I don't know how the hell you guys did this, but you're lucky to get it, because it was, as I say, we're the only ones to do that, and we didn't have the muscle that you had from the network stations and all the media, like Sports Illustrated. Sweden had a crew over there, a crew from Sweden, cover the fights and so on. And one quick point. We went over then, I'll have to admit, to the Sonny Liston camp, which was a place then called Aurora Downs. They had a racetrack at Aurora at one time. People forget that. And that tape was came got out of Central Casting. The crowd there was not very friendly. And here was Liston working the music. The night he had a record of night train playing constantly when he would skip rope and hit the bevy bag. And one other point I recall, he had a small, they wanted lighter guys fighting, sparring with Liston. They wanted to emulate Patterson to stick and run and things like that. And Liston hit so hard at these guys, they could hardly stick and run. One shot, they already almost go down. And what happened was, Joe Polino was handling the affairs for Liston at that time. Stick and run! He started, the guy, keep sticking! And some wise guy in the audience said, stick and run, that's it. And Polino turned over. I'm not going to say what he said, but he indicated to keep his blankety mouth shut, or else you could hear a church, it was like a church mouse at that place. It was unbelievable. Liston crowd was unbelievable, as you know. Then, of course, Patterson was KO'd in one round by Liston.
Well, I can see by you going after that Patterson interview, the Bulldog, nickname, you can see it's very clear why you had that nickname. Do you remember who first gave you that nickname by any chance?
Well, actually, I didn't really get it until I went into the business there, like you mentioned, in Rockford, in Chicago. It's not because a lot of people think I had that name because there was a detective, English detective, who was made into the movies and books by the name of Bulldog Drummond. Some people may remember that. But allegedly, they did it because of my supposed tenacity in getting stories.
I think that's it.
I felt good at getting Patterson. But my question on this long-winded story that I wanted to pat myself in the back is, we do have stills of Liston and Patterson working on your glossies. Nice shot. Would they be worth it? They're not autographed.
No, those have stamps on the back, like UPI or AP photo stamps or dated stamps on the back of the photos?
They'd have something on it, but they would probably be WRAX-TV, which is not the nationally known organization.
Okay,
not
that's
the wire.
Okay.
These are own people that I don't know if they've been. They're beautiful glossies.
Yeah, those should have some value, right, Bill? Because they were printed at the time, so they'd be Type 1 photos.
Oh, yeah, and they're probably not. They may not be published photos, which makes me even tougher.
Yeah,
they're not wire service photos or anything. The only thing now, I first admit that the interest in boxing has declined so much that it's a lot, at one time that wasn't the case.
It's still big in with collectors though, I would definitely get all those original photos and put them in your Huggins and Scott auction box because those would be good if they were taken in the 60s or older. And they were printed at the time within a year.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Then those are good. The bigger names, you know, the better. You have anything like of Ali or,
Not anything like that. I had pictures when I was with Ali at the interview, but not anything other than that. But, this also showed, Gus D'Amato, who is the manager of
Mike Tyson,
Patterson, and also showing Patterson's peekaboo style that brought him to the championship. That was the way he put his head, the way his style of fighting.
Sonny Liston was a big puncher also.
When I went away to that place, I was shaking. I wouldn't want to meet I wouldn't want to meet a dark alley. It would be Sonny Liston, because this guy was a bruiser and he was a tough guy. And I still wonder to this day how he got KO'd by Patterson and L.E. in one round in Lewiston, Maine. I wonder about that.
Yeah, there was a big question whether that was he was on the take for that one, right?
I know, that's the point, whether he was in the take. Yeah. We'll never know, as of course, Sonny's dead now.
Yeah. Boy, Bill, Sonny Liston, any autographed items of him, those are all big, right?
I think asking Sonny to publish
it. Sonny, could you sign this for me? Boom!
Listen, one other point, I'm not BSing. He had a PR guy there, Archie something. I remember that after he worked out. He said, well, listen, this here, he pointed out to Liston coming down, because this was a joint, this was a news conference, this one-on-one. He said, this here is Sonny Liston, he's the next heavyweight champion of the world. You treat him like you would the President of the United States. That's the type of crowd they had. And Liston had such a glare on him all the time. You know, he wasn't the most articulate guy to begin with.
Yeah.
He was a bad egg.
just a boxer.
Of course, he did his time in his Missouri State Pen. He's a tough guy.
Oh, boy.
He's a tough guy, physically. There's no denying that. Very formidable looking. I couldn't believe he got KO'd by Ali, but he did.
You know, after the next break, I want to ask about the NFL draft coming up. If you covered any and what it was like, you know, back in the 60s. It's such a big show now and everything. Let's get to Sean from Highland Park here before we get to that. Sean, thanks for waiting. What do you have?
Hey, good morning, fellas. I got a question. In 2012, I was in the military, and a going away gift from my commander, he worked it out with the Kansas City Royals. For me to come in and get a tour and throw out a first pitch at a game.
Wow, really?
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. I'm a diehard Royals fan before they went all the way. I ended up throwing it out to Mike Moustakas. And Army tradition is you take your patch off and you give it to the guy. And that's what I did. And I guess he really appreciated that because he took his ball cap off and gave me his ball cap.
Wow, that's really cool.
It was cool. It had a couple of personal inscriptions on the inside. It said, play each day like it's the first and last time somebody sees you. And then it had his initials and his, then at that time, fiance's initials inside. And my wife's been on me ever since I got this thing to get it insured. It's in the man cave. I really never thought anything about it, but just for, I kind of wanted to know what kind of value something like that had in case I did need to get it insured.
Yeah.
And figured maybe you guys could help me out on that.
What type of estimate would you give to that, Bill Huggins?
Well, gosh, Sean, it probably has way more value to your family than it would, possibly because the story that you just told behind it kind of doesn't come with the past, so to speak. But,
sure.
I would venture to say that thing would sell, you know, with the story behind it and published and all that and your military service, all this, got to be $500 to $1,000 or more.
And the fact that they did win the World Series, you clearly, if this was 2012, you were a Royals fan before they were good, so.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like I said, I would never sell it, not for any dollar amount, but
right.
I do want to
keep
the wife happy and keep it insured.
And okay, thanks, guys, thanks you for your much. Service also.
No worries.
So the value of
have
that
a great
is,
day. Have a happy Sunday.
Okay, you too.
Value of that is priceless then.
Yes, it really is. Yep, well, now it's time for a short break. The number's 312-332-3776. Give us a call with a question about the value of your collectibles. We're giving away a Panini Contenders Draft Picks football box with 5 autographs in it. And we're on till 9 a.m. And we do have John Drummond, former longtime Channel 2 Chicago newsman, on with us, a great storyteller. So hang in there, we'll be right back.
Now back to Sports Collecting with Tom Morgan.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Morgan with Vince Clementi of ERC Delivery and Bill Huggins of Huggins and Scott Auctions. And we have a celebrity guest this week, longtime Channel 2 Chicago newsman John Bulldog Drummond with us. We're taking your questions about the value of your collectibles, or if you have a question for John, you can give us a call at 312-332-3776. We're giving away a Panini Contenders football box with 5 autographs in it. And before we get to questions or anything like that, any calls, I want to mention a couple of things. I just noticed, Bill, in the Huggins and Scott May auction, you have a T206 Lennox Brownback Hal Chase holding trophy card graded just a good 2 with a mark on it, which doesn't seem like that big a deal. But in those T206, the tobacco cards, what can be really big is the scarcity of the backs. And according to T206resource.com, that's the third toughest to find card back. I don't think there have been many of those cards even out in the for the public to even get them, have there, with that back on it, Bill?
No, we've had very, very few of them over the last 15 years or so. And when they do surface, these collectors who are putting together a master setter, so to speak, they certainly stand up, take notice. And this thing, I think it's the highest graded one of that, even though it's only a 2. But it could bring several thousand dollars easily.
Wow. That's something else. Yeah, some of those card backs, you just don't see them. A lot of times you'll see the Piedmonts or whatever, but not that type of back. I don't think I've ever seen one where anybody's ever brought one in or even for sale. So it's really something. Now, John Drummond, before the break, I had brought up the fact of how big of a deal television and everything that the NFL draft is. Did you ever cover an NFL draft, like in the 60s?
No, not as per se, although I talked to interviewed some of the people behind the scenes. I was not there present when the draft was going on. First of all, there wasn't that deal of interest. And number two, the people forget at that time, you had as many as up to 15 draft picks, 12 to 15 draft picks compared to today. And what really sparked the interest in that is finally when the American Football League came in 1960, and there was a contest, so to speak, between the old NFL and AFL, to sign these guys. And then the interest in the draft began to peak, but it's nowhere near like it was today. Mm-hmm. The interest in it was just, they maybe send a beat reporter up and that would be about it. Today you think it's this, you think it's the biggest thing since the sinking of Lusitania.
Well, it is, John. It is.
Yeah, it is. That's right. Now, my first year I remember watching the Bears was the year that they drafted Butkus and Sayers. Think about
65.
That. Yeah, 65. Yeah. And I'm, you know, to me, it's like, okay, you've got one of the greatest running backs ever, probably the best linebacker ever, and you, the team wasn't that great, but you got to watch a fantastic player on both sides of the ball, and I was hooked. I mean, yeah. From that point on, Gale Sayers, the open field running, he was so much fun to watch. It was really something else. And Butkus, literally, he didn't just tackle guys; he strong armed them, buried their head in the dirt. Yeah. You know, it wasn't just a tackle with him. Did you see many of the Bears games when they were
heyday? I saw quite a few of the Bears games. Well, first of all, they had Wrigley Field until, of course, 1970. There was the last year, and then they went to 71. So I saw Butkus and Sayers and some of those players, and they certainly. And I remember the 63 team. You mentioned Butkus a lot, but a lot of people forget, I think, that Bill George.
Oh, yeah. Another Hall of Famer.
He was probably the first great real middle linebacker you had, and I think he was tremendous. He doesn't get the ink that Nitschke or Sam Huff did or that in that period, but I think he was the key instrument in the Bears winning that championship in 1963 was Bill George, who died away, by the way, in an automobile accident, if I recall. But,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was very good. He was, I think, I'm not belittling Butkus and Sayre.
No.
But I think the interest in pro football got bigger, too, and that's another reason why Butkus got a lot of ink, just like Mike Singletary got a lot of ink because of those eyes he'd have when the camera was don't kid yourself. That makes a difference.
Right. Huggins and Scott ran in the February auction. They had a football from the greatest game ever played, which it was a touchdown pass from Johnny Unitas to Raymond Berry. And they actually, they sold that football in an auction that went for like $62,000, right, wow. Bill? But you had great provenance with that too—a letter from Raymond Berry and the whole deal.
Oh yeah, that was amazing. The provenance and the trail of the history of the ball from where the guy caught it in the stands, he happened to be 67 inches tall in 1958, which was huge, I think, back then. And that's how he caught the ball. He kind of reached up and grabbed it as it went through the upright.
The extra point kick, yeah, after the touchdown. Yeah.
Well, there's no question, that game
that turned things.
And that's when the NFL came into its heyday.
Yeah.
Before that, it was really big maybe in just certain cities, but that just, people went hog wild about the NFL, and the NFL the number one spectator sport in the country. One point on those drafts, I remember one year they had a bonus draft at one time. This was before the AFL started. This was in the 50s. And I remember the Steelers had the bonus. They drafted a guy named Gary Glick, who was from Colorado A&M or something like that. There was hardly any interest. That was not a big deal. There's no headlines on that type of stuff. The draft was really a second-rate story at that time.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't mean anything. I'm serious. Ho-hum. That's what it was.
Remember when Don Nottingham, I think it was the final pick in the draft and ended
the human
up
bowling ball.
Yeah, he ended up having a good career. He was very good.
Right.
Now, we've got callers waiting, but before we get to them, you've got to talk about your movie career. Okay, we know you were in The Fugitive. And weren't you in the first movie that Sharon Stone was ever in?
My main claim to fame was I was in the movie. That was a cultural. I mean, it was being sort of a. It became quite a character film because Sharon Stone was the first film in it, as also Steven Seagal was the first one in it as well.
Really?
So they're both in that.
Now, what was your role in that movie?
I was a reporter again, but my biggest claim, the biggest excitement was I was in the makeup room next to Pam Grier. I remember that.
Oh, really?
I thought she was great. Yeah, she was in that movie also, by the way.
That's cool. Now, did you save any of your contracts or any movie memorabilia from any of those movies?
Well, I had a couple of pictures taken in front of a trailer and that type of stuff, but that'd be about all. I'm afraid I mean, Harrison Ford and those guys, and if you'd got a little more top billing than I did.
Yeah.
Although, by the way, in justice to myself, the first voice you hear on The Fugitive, since you brought it up, the first voice you hear is yours truly, Drummond speaking.
Really? Wow.
No. Everyone has to go watch that movie now again. It's a good movie anyway. I remember you in the interviewing towards the end of the movie, right? Is where you're interviewing, there's a group of reporters.
Yes, there was.
One of the guys.
At one of the buildings inside, we're trying to get a hold of Tommy, trying to interview Tommy Lee Jones and some questions. One thing about that Fugitive, I can bring it up very quickly. They shot at night, so I had to work the next day and the Sunday night. And I recall they wound me down at 3 o'clock down at Armitage in Wisconsin, where that scene was being shot of where Harrison Ford's wife was going to be killed. And I got there at 3 o'clock. The guy gives me one of the young producer execs gives me a script. He says, "Now memorize this stuff." I sat in that trailer for 6 hours. 9 o'clock, the guy pounds on the door. "Come on, it's time to eat." He went out, we ate like kings in those days. I think he ate a swordfish or prime rib. But anyway, get back, and he's like, then they call me out about 11 o'clock. He said, the guy says to me, your script? Yeah, I said, I got every word. Yes, sir. I come up to Andy Davis, who then was the director on the set, came onto the scene, on the set, and he said, your lines? I said, yes, sir, Mr. Davis, I know every one of my lines. He said, forget it. He said, I won't use the word that we read. Blank can it. You're going to wing it and pretend you don't know hardly anything. People would be more realistic that way.
Really?
And we did it in one take.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
That's cool. So did you have a chance to talk to Harrison Ford or Tom? It was Tommy Lee?
I met Ford, and then Jones, we did at a news impromptu news conference. I did meet Jones, and a couple of questions I asked, I guess, didn't go along very well, and they cut that piece out. Jones was a very talented guy, but sort of a prima donna guy, was my opinion.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, that was my opinion, yeah.
Yeah,
but he was a very talented guy. He won an Oscar for that role, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, now I really got to see that movie again. Okay, now we're going to get to some callers here. We've got Brett from Itasca's on the line. Thanks for waiting. Brett, what do you have?
Yeah, good morning. How are you guys?
Great.
Good. I have got a Bart Starr signed football. It's interesting. The football itself is more of that orange color. It's very slick. It's an older football, and I was wondering if you guys had an idea of what that might be worth. Obviously, in bear country, maybe not as much as Packer country.
Well, it would be fun to play with, take
sure.
it out to the yard.
A few times.
Yeah, right. Bill Huggins, does an older football matter on the value of the Bart Starr signature?
Well, was it signed back then? I mean, was it signed back in the 60s or 70s, or was it something that was signed more recently?
I'm not 100% sure. I've had it for over probably 20 years. It was given to me by an uncle.
Because if it's a vintage signature, those do bring quite a bit more than the ones where he signs at card shows and things like that.
Maybe if you can tweet a picture of it or email a picture of it, we'd be able to give you a better idea on that. But
I mean, you're talking the difference between 100 and 200 and possibly the difference between 400 and 500.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Very good. Now, John Drummond, did you ever have a chance to cover or meet Vince Lombardi? Did you interview him?
I certainly did. In fact, I went out to the Madison had an organization called the Pen and Mike Club. And this was in 63, and I went up and did an exclusive interview with Lombardi. I rigged him through the athletic director at the University of Wisconsin named Ivy Williams, and he set the interview up, even though there wasn't supposed to be any interviews, and Lombardi was very unhappy. And I remember starting the interview with him. They had made a trade getting rid of Jim Ringo, who was our star center, and made some comments on that. And he said, "That's how much you know." He was a very grumpy guy, but it was quite a coup because Lombardi was very unique. He didn't give interviews up at all, so we did talk to him, you betcha.
And he was ripping on you, huh?
Yeah, at the start, the question, he says, "You don't know what you're talking about." Well, actually, I had, because that trade, it was Bill Quinlan with the trade. Bill Quinlan was a great defensive end. They traded him because he had made some derogatory remarks about Lombardi that got back to Lombardi, and he canned him for that really big defensive end.
He gone.
And the result is that first game in 63, the Bears beat the Packers 10-3 because they ran around the end of a guy named Nelson Aldridge who had replaced Quinlan, and that was their weak spot. Had Quinlan been there, it might have been different. And Quinlan made the remark. He referred to, I'll tell you what he said, he referred to Lombardi, supposedly got back to him. He called him the Jap. And because he did, it was a very, very, very racially bad name, and Lombardi got enraged. That's the story I heard.
Oh, really? Wow. Now, who was more intimidating, George Halas or Lombardi?
I think Lombardi, even though Halas was very crusty. He was a very crusty guy like that, but somehow you could handle it. But Lombardi was definitely more intimidating. There's no question about it.
Yeah, that's what I would have figured on that one. Okay, we have, let's see here, from Palos Heights, we've got a caller. I'm not sure the name here, but what do you have?
Hey, I've got a NBA basketball with a number of Hall of Fame basketball players signing it. Michael Jordan, Dominique Wilkins, Rick Barry, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Wow. All Hall of Famers? Thomas.
Yeah, every one of them Hall of Famers.
Okay, that's good.
And the reason, the way we got the autographs were back in the 80s, McCormick Place used to have a huge sporting goods show. And all of them guys, except Jordan, we got Jordan's in the 90s when he was with the Bulls and things. But the other guys we got when they were making appearances at the sporting goods show for their whatever sponsors they were representing. So I was just wondering.
With that group, Bill, and including Jordan, I'm thinking that's probably over $1,000, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, depending on how many signatures,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Is Wilt?
No, we don't have Wilt. It's just, I'm in my truck right now.
Okay.
We got about 7 or 8, and they're all Hall of Famers. There's no other signatures.
Good,
on
that's
all.
Good.
It's just, you know, it's Jordan, Thomas, Isaiah Thomas, Rick Barry, Dominique Wilkins.
Well, that would definitely be worthwhile in a Huggins and Scott auction. If you think you want to send it in, call them at 301-608-0355. I saw you have a Wilt Chamberlain single signed basketball in the May auction, Bill. So, you know, I've got a Hall of Fame. I noticed I got some graded stuff back from PSA, and I didn't even realize this. They have a PSA DNA has a Hall of Fame NBA autograph registry, and I actually have a Maurice Stokes autograph. It's a great story. We'll tell it another time, the Jack Twyman Maurice Stokes connection. But there's guys, I mean, those just aren't for sale. That's a pretty good autograph to have. Okay, we've got one more caller here on the line. Or no, we don't. Okay, it looks like... Okay, he dropped. All right. So we still have we're almost at the end here again. I'll tell you, John Bulldog Drummond, we didn't get everything that we wanted to talk about today even.
We didn't. And by the way, if I can interject this about stuff as collectibles. You guys interviewed, I know the time, you said that, Tom, and I think Bill, unfortunately, a lot of magazines and stuff of that nature, because, of course, you're shipping, you're paying shipping and handling costs. Even like you mentioned, the old Who's Who in baseball, which I have many of those back to 50.
Yeah, not much.
That doesn't
value.
Seem to ring a bell with you guys. You weren't frothing at the mouth.
No, no. Those are, they're heavy and not that valuable. You know, they're fun to read, to look through, but don't you agree, Bill, a lot of those old magazines, not that valuable.
No, you got to get back into the 20s or teens before they start to get valuable.
Well,
how about Street and Smith, the football magazines that came out in 1940? Is that much value? Of course, they're no longer in business.
They'd have to be, like, perfect condition.
Yeah, that's, you know, pristine condition. Yeah.
Yeah, it's time to do the drawing. But, John Drummond, if you're ever listening to the show, you hear us talking about something and you have something to add, give us a buzz, because it was great having you on. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll see you guys later. Thank you now.
Okay.
Bye.
This week's winner is Sean from Highland Park. Email me, vince@aircdelivery.com. Send me your address, Sean, and I'll send it out to you free of charge.
Okay, and we're on every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Central Time, taking your questions about the value of your collectibles. Sorry, guys, that we couldn't get to this week, but that was priceless, some of the stories from John Drummond. And thanks again, John. Eric Ostrowski, our producer, another great job. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.